Welcome everyone, and it's so good to see so many of you interested in this conversation today. This is a hybrid event. There will be people joining us online and of course in person, and today we're here to talk about the land of never-ending elections and the 2022 midterms, and will any of it make any difference? Right. My name is Pavi Suryanarayan. I'm an assistant professor in the government department here at the NSC, and I'm pleased to welcome two eminent speakers on this topic. First, Professor Philip Davies, who's the chair of the American Politics Group at the Political Studies Association. He's had an illustrious career as an American expert. He was formerly the director of the British Library's Eccles Center for American Studies. Is Professor Emeritus at De Montfort University and a distinguished fellow at Oxford University's Rothermere American Institute. In conversation with him is Marcia Feliciano, who is the founding director of the Benjamin Franklin House. She holds a PhD in economic history right from right here at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And today we will be exploring the upcoming midterm elections and what it means for Americans and what it means for us as a global audience. Now, there will be plenty of chance for you guys out here in the audience to ask your questions. For our online audience who can hear us, please submit your questions through the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. When you speak, please make sure to introduce yourself and tell us about your affiliation. And when we open the floor up to Q&A, the audience is welcome to join in. And I'll do my best to try and keep, you know, parity between the in-person and online audience. And so with that, the floor is yours, Marcia and Philip.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Pavi. It is great to be here. It's really exciting. I'm very proud of my alma mater. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about Benjamin Franklin House first and the genesis for this talk. This is actually the 11th iteration of the Robert H. Smith Lecture in American Democracy. And we did most of them at the Eccles Center for American Studies at the British Library, where Phil was the chair, before coming over last year to the LSE. So really excited about that. Benjamin Franklin House is the only house still standing where Benjamin Franklin lived and worked. I hope that each one of you online and here in person are going to take a short walk from the Trafalgar Square to where the house is located on Craven Street. It's some strange twist of fate that the only house still standing is in London, not in Boston, where Franklin was born, not in Philadelphia, which was his adopted city, not in Paris, in France, where he spent about 8 years during the revolution, but he spent the greater part of 16 years right here in London. And his mission was to try and keep Britain and America together under the crown. He tried lots of ways to do that. It didn't quite work out the way that he had planned initially, but when it came time to choose, he knew what side he was on, even though he was very much of both worlds. His father came from Ecton in Northamptonshire, and his mother was born on the island of Nantucket off the coast of Massachusetts. His life dates are 1706 to 1790. So he lived to be more than double the life expectancy at the time. He died at 84 years old. And I think that's because he never stopped being curious, never stopped doing, never stopped learning. So I think there's something in that for all of us. But we inherited a derelict building in maybe about 20 years ago or so that the then governors had found enough money to do the exterior stabilization of the building, but we wanted to turn it into a museum and educational facility. And I'm sure Franklin had a hand in that because everything came together in order to be able to open on Franklin's 300th birthday in 2006. And we do three things at Benjamin Franklin House. We have a main public offering, which is called our historical experience. It's really a piece of theater that runs through the spaces. So it's live performance, sound, visual projection, to tell the story of Franklin's life in London. To the extent that people know anything about him on this side of the Atlantic, sometimes they think he was a president, but actually he's a generation older than the first presidents, although he was the president for a time of Pennsylvania, but that's another story. They don't know so much about this very rich history of his time in London. So that's what we try and reveal. We also have a student science center where we focus on Franklin's London science. And he was advancing principles related to electricity, hydrodynamics, you name it, he was doing it. He even invented an instrument called the glass harmonica that a lot of people composed for, like Bach, one of them, Beethoven, and others, including Mozart. So he was extremely busy. We get Franklin's ideas around innovation, the scientific method, to our students. And we've served nearly 40,000 school children since we opened, free of charge. All of our educational provision is free, even though we're quite poor, because we don't want price to be a barrier to entry. And the third thing that we do, of which this is an example, is we try and be a convening point around Franklin and the very myriad ideas that he was associated with. The reason this is called the Robert H. Smith Lecture in American Democracy is because we had a wonderful supporter in Robert H. Smith, who really believed in the history of America's founding and, you know, what that could tell subsequent generations about trying to create a society in which it is you can live freely and share ideas and not be subjected to any type of tyranny. So Phil's going to tell us if the US has managed that. But we began this lecture, as I said, a number of years ago to honor the memory of Robert H. Smith, and we're delighted that you are here to join us. I want to clarify something, Pavi, that you said, in that I am not a US election specialist, thank goodness. So that is all on Phil's shoulder. Actually, Phil, to begin our conversation, tell me, why are you a U.S. election specialist? How did that come about?
I went to university to do maths and geography discovered when I was there that actually, while I enjoyed that, there were other subjects knocking around that one could do. Ultimately, it was a long cruise as I kind of chose these things. Realized that in studying initially American state and local government, and then the elections within state and local government, I could combine maths and geography and actually apply it to a society. And I always wanted to study some other country than the UK, and my language skills are appalling. my French professor told me I spoke French common vache espagnol. At that point, I was quite down at heel, down at heart. I met a geology professor who invited me to his home with his wife. His wife served this some food that I didn't know. I asked about that. And he said, oh, well, we learned how to create this food in Mallorca. He said, my speciality is the geology of Mallorca. And therefore, whenever I'm not teaching, we just have to go to Mallorca. You know, it's not a choice. It's just it's research defined our life. And I thought, this man's a genius. I've got to find my location for this. And then again, in the course of my first year at university, I went to a random lecture and it was given by a very brilliant professor of American studies, Michael David Keith Adams. And it was on the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Mm. And I thought, why am I doing maths? I thought. The shift was to American studies to use my skills, and eventually elections became the thing.
And before we get on to the midterm elections, I know that you actually have an amazing collection of election paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Is that right? Tell us about that.
I've actually found somewhere to put it. the curator of the Bodleian once saw me giving a lecture using this material that I collected, and he asked me if they could borrow some of it for an exhibition in an election year. This is 20 years ago. And so absolutely fine. I said, as long as you come to my house and pick it up and bring it back, it's fine. And he did that. And when he brought it back after they'd used it for about 3 or 4 months, we sat in the kitchen having a cup of tea. Then he said to me, Phil, have you thought what you might do with this material in the long run? And I leaned across the table and touched his arm and said, John, my wife is going to be so pleased that we met, because it meant we could actually empty the bedroom, the loft, the garage, and various other rooms of the house of the material. And so it's brilliant. I can keep collecting, and I know that someone will take care of it. It is now housed at the Rothermere American Institute in Oxford. It is, as far as we know, the largest collection available for research anywhere outside of the USA.
And what kinds of things are in it?
The earliest pieces from 1813, which is a pamphlet challenging an election result in Virginia. There's material from the Know Nothing Party, from the Greenbackers, from William Henry Harrison's presidential campaign, right through to contemporary elections, and at every level. And even I keep learning stuff. I just bought a collection of matchbook covers, because in the days of smoking, which it was one of the materials that people printed campaign messages on. Basically, American politicians are entrepreneurial, and as soon as the opportunity to print anything on a material came, they used it. So matchbook covers I bought about 150 of them recently. And amongst them, I found election materials of jailers, and it was the first time I realized that in Kentucky and Kentucky alone, they elect county jailers. So everywhere.
That might be a little bit obscure for a politician to think, but all right, let's get on to the midterm elections.
Yeah.
What are they, and why are they important?
Well, everybody knows, I guess everybody watching this knows, you know, it's a presidential election once every 4 years. You notice it's on Twitter. And in the interim, halfway between them, there is an election for not involving the president, but certainly involving the whole of the House of Representatives and one third of the US Senate. And in the Senate also occasionally some special elections if somebody died or retired. But usually about 33 to 35 senators will be up for election. But also in the midterms, there are quite a few other elections going on that are significant. So quite a few governorships will be on. It's up to the states to decide when they when they elect their governors. Many of them, most of them, choose not to do it in the presidential year. So they do it either in the midterm year or even in an off year instead. 48 of the 50 states have governors with quadrennial elections, two do not. The states also elect a whole swath of other offices: lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, comptroller, treasurer. It varies from state to state. One of the things that I'm sure many of my audience realize, that every time you get asked a question on American domestic politics, the first line of the answer is it varies from state to state. There are hundreds of more. There are over 500,000 elected offices in the United States. While they don't all come up every year or even every odd year, nonetheless, it does mean that in every election year, certainly in midterm year, there are hundreds of thousands of elections. For instance, there are at state legislatures, there are 7,000 members of state legislatures, state senates, state houses, bicameral in every state except Nebraska, which is a unicameral one, and supposedly non-partisan, but actually controlled by the Republicans. So there's a lot going on. And another thing perhaps that certainly many non-American viewers might not realize is that an awful lot of American politics goes on at the state level. And certain budgets like education and roads and so on and so forth, there's much greater expenditure at the state level than from the federal level. And the states do have a considerable amount of autonomy. And with recent Supreme Court decisions, they appear to be gaining more autonomy in these areas. So those elections are tremendously important.
And do you think they've become more important over time, or is that constant?
Have the midterms become more important? That's a good question. I think so. Let me drag one statistic, which I hope I've got accurate. The presidential party tends not to do well at midterm elections. Well, partly this is understandable. They're the incumbent party, and people get pissed off at incumbent parties and tend to give them a bit of a kicking when things come around. And in first midterm elections, the ones 2 years after the president is the new president has been elected, they tend to do even worse. So since 1946, the average loss by an incumbent presidential party at the midterm have been 29 seats at their first midterm election. 26 seats on average, but 29 at the first midterm, I say they tend to be a little bit worse. But in the last four midterm, first midterm elections, what in one, the presidential party gained seats. George Bush, after 9/11, gained 8 seats, if I remember rightly. But in the other three, the losses were 40, 54, and 63. Huge. Much more than the average in recent years. And the only times in previous years that you've seen those kinds of losses have been at wartime or massive depression, collapse, economic. So it would appear it's one statistic, not necessarily randomly chosen, but it would appear that perhaps they are becoming more significant.
Hmm. And what's the significance for an international audience? Should they care about what happens in the US midterms?
I've always thought the domestic elections in the States should be watched. I've very occasionally been asked to consult for the Foreign Office here. Not very often, actually. I'm kind of zealous, you know, if they can't find anybody. And one of the things that I have tried to put over and have found a receptive audience for amongst my Foreign Office colleagues, who are a brilliant lot, I have to say, is that you need to have an idea of what's going on in Kansas, in Arizona, certainly in Texas and Florida and California, if you're going to draw conclusions about American foreign policy. There are two aspects to this. One is that these American populations may well have their primary interest in their own economy, their own school systems, and so on and so forth. But they also have opinions on foreign policy. And drawing on that second point is that you've got to be aware of those opinions. If people are primarily voting on the basis of domestic issues, but those domestic issues drive them towards, say, a more conservative or a more liberal perspective in their own view, then that's clearly going to have a rebound effect on the opinions of their elected officials when it comes to observing diplomatic policy, foreign policy, the place of America in the world.
So currently the Democrats have a very slim majority in Congress. Chances are that the House will flip, but could the Democrats hold on to the Senate? And what would need to happen in order?
It's very close. It is very close. If you look at the national opinion polls yesterday, on average, there's a website called Real Clear Politics, and it does some. An average of recent national polls, and it does a 10-day average, which it updates every day. And yesterday, it had Republicans in the lead by 0.9%, which effectively means about 4% one way or the other. So there's no 10 at the moment, except that the Republicans have consistently had that modest lead in the election. But of course, it's filtered through the constituencies, and the constituencies, both, if you can call states constituencies, because they are for Senate seats anyway, the constituencies are structured in such a way that doesn't necessarily turn 1% lead or a 4% lead into a 4% lead in seats gained. So, for example, at the moment, as we know, the Senate has 50 Democrats, well, 48 Democrats and two independents who vote with Democrats, and 50 Republicans. But those 50 Republicans represent 40 million fewer voters than the Democrats and their allies, because of the different sizes of the states and the way they are constitutionally given two senators each. In the House, it's rather more complex because the states have an allocation of seats that depended on the previous census, but then the state legislatures, in most cases, in all cases, about seven states don't do it this way, but 43 of the states. Politically, the legislatures design the constituencies, and while they have to keep them of pretty much equal size, pretty good, they're better than the British doing that, they also can design them so that they capture modest party margins in some seats and large numbers of party margins in other seats, such as to bias the eventual results. So, for instance, in North Carolina, where again, roughly 50% of the vote goes to the Republicans and 50% goes to the Democrats. Nevertheless, two-thirds of the seats go to the Republicans because the constituencies have been designed to do that. So, yes, the chances are that the Republicans will almost certainly take control of the House of Representatives. In Senate, it is closer, but it could actually be several seats either way, or a dead heat again, because there are quite a few seats that are so close. Pennsylvania, where you've got Dr. Oz against John Fetterman. Thank you. The margins keep swinging quite closely. J.D. Vance is also, I think, 1% ahead of his Democratic opponent. So you certainly have got a number of states where things could go either way. If we went back 6 months, I think you would say the Republicans felt quite cheerful about their prospects, not just in House but also in Senate. The Democrats have gained heart, and there is a sense that they may maintain their 50-50, or even, I would say that the most go up to about 52. I don't think any more than that.
But Phil, the polls have gotten it so wrong. Maybe Democrats are more likely to respond to the polls, might skew the results. Can we trust the polls?
Polls on the whole aren't wrong. You know, the polls in the Clinton-Trump thing, you know, a lot of stuff we hear about Clinton having been a terrible candidate and all that kind of thing. She got 3 million more votes than Trump. And if you look through the polls on the previous day, virtually all of them had her 2 to 3% ahead. What is difficult and what they didn't get right is filtering that through the constituencies. And it is hard. It is hard. You need a lot of really deep level stuff to be able to do that. So as a broad guide, the polls are actually pretty good. But when it comes to things being so close in so many places, you know, a local swing in you know, the Southwest or a few states or something like that can make quite a substantial difference at that margin. So you take them with a pinch of salt, but they are skillfully done and quite an accurate guide, but they're no more than a guide.
Mm. So I wanted to ask you about the politicization of American democracy. What do you think, has it become more so? Or is it that we have this frame of reference of the last, you know, however many years, and when you look to the longer span of US history, were there other moments when it was equally politicized?
There have been periods where things have been, you know, quite brutal. In the 19th century, this is before women were allowed to vote, except in two states. And certainly, you know, both in, well, when you look back at Andrew Jackson, for instance, which was when the Whigs were formed, because they saw Andrew Jackson as being a president who wanted to be a monarch. Mm-hmm. And so he was a Tory, and so what were they? They'd be Whigs. And indeed, they had some temporary success, and then in 1854, the Republicans emerged from the remnants of the Whig Party. But at that time, they were accusing Jackson of murder, for instance, as a famous lizard. That you can find. It's a reference to his career as a military leader, actually. I think it was Madison who was accused of importing gambling equipment into the White House. It was a snooker table. So things could be pretty brutal. And certainly in the late 19th century, it was fairly knockabout politics. But of course, the period that we tend to refer to, and that people as old as me remember, is a kind of post-war, post-Second World War period. And certainly the whole first section of that, right up until the late 60s, was a period of, if you like, compromise and coalition politics. Didn't always look like that, because you still had two parties. They were different, but there was, if you looked at the political opinions of the supporters of these parties, the graphs overlapped, and there was a huge chunk in the middle where there was room for compromise, there was room for discussion. And over time, that shifted. And if you look at the political map now, if you like, the two parties, there's really no overlap in belief and ideology. And they have become very separated over time. It seems to me that the key change turning point of this is 1968, the late 1960s, when faith in American institutions, post-war faith in American institutions, Congress, the presidency, the Supreme Court, police, judges, so on and so forth, with newspapers, was very high. Even if differences between me thinking there should be, I don't know, a good welfare system and you thinking people should stand their own two feet existed. But, you know, faith in the institutions that would deliver these was very high. And perhaps among the key things were the Vietnam War and Watergate. There's a collapse of faith in certain institutions, which has just continued since then. For instance, one of the things that feeds into midterm elections is satisfaction with the president as president. And at the moment that stands at minus 10% satisfaction with Biden. What's the figure for satisfaction with Congress? It's minus 44. and it wasn't a definite deal. But there's a difference there in that people think Congress isn't doing a due job, but they think my member of Congress is different to the others. Because he or she is doing something good for me. The faith in these institutions collapsed, the polarization is shifting, primaries have become more important than general elections in many, many constituencies. This means the battle is between either a moderately right-wing person, a more right-wing person, or between a moderately left-wing person, a more left-wing person. And since primaries draw to them the most energized members of the party, they tend to drive things even further in this polarized fashion.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question about demography, and it you and I and Javi had a chance to talk about this before the session began. And it's really a question about the divide between urban and rural, city and country. If we leave ideology aside, is this what is really driving things?
It's certainly one of the things that's driving things. As I said in that discussion earlier on, the other day I was listening to somebody else's discussion and they said there are a lot of moving parts, and I thought, I'll have that. There are a lot of moving parts, but certainly there is this division which has a political impact, and it's based on reality. There's one thing called, for instance, the big sword. And this is the fact that people tend to go and live with other people who are in the same kind of business, who like the same kind of environment, who tend to have similar political views. And so on the whole, and it's a sweeping generalization, I recognize, Democrats go for bigger cities and urban spaces, and Republicans go for rural spaces and perhaps more suburban spaces, though suburban spaces are becoming more contested. So that tends to happen, and that has political consequences because of the, if you're concentrating votes in that way, then gerrymandering becomes more easy for the party that's in charge of the, in charge of the state. But also, if you look at the economic development of the United States in the last 30 years or so, what you find is that many of those rural and small town areas have suffered economically. Their industries have gone, their big industries have gone. Agribusiness has taken over the small farm in many places. And if you look at America, has done really well internationally in terms of its growth of GDP. But if you look at where that GDP is generated, it's generated in a rather small number of heavily Democratic counties. And urban counties. And so that indicates, on the one hand, the kind of stress that, if you like, the flyover states suffer and two, the kind of misperception in those states of what's going on, because they still see themselves as the generators of the American economy, and they're not. Currently, they are needing. I'm not saying that wheat is not a really good thing, and pigs, and all those things. And indeed, the Fortune 100 companies that are headquartered in Nebraska and other places too. But in terms of generalizations, you've got different experiences of the American economy, and if you like, using hyperbole, of the American dream, and it does, it is reflected then in senses of satisfaction, contentment on one hand, and disappointment, dismay, sense of abandonment on the other.
Well, I hope that one of you online or in the audience will ask Phil a question that I wanted to ask him about the impact of the media and whether they are king or queen maker. But I think, Pavi, I should turn it over to you. But I hope it will give you the luxury of asking one final question as we wrap up about Benjamin Franklin and what he would think. So over to you.
So I'm going to use my discretion as chair to ask Phil a question. We all saw January 20th happen. So how much does that play into how we should think about the midterm elections? Is democracy on the ballot?
This is really in January 6th. It is really interesting because both, if you ask American voters a direct question about the threat to democracy, it's widely perceived. And it's one of those questions on which quite a lot of people of different political opinions agree with it. But then you ask the second question, what's the threat? And it changes. It's like when you ask in a poll, what are the main issues that you concern? And healthcare often comes up. And, all right, it's broadly agreed. But what's happening is that two groups of people are answering that. One of them is saying there's not enough access to healthcare. And the other one saying it's getting too costly for me to pay because all these people are getting access. So in terms of the threat to democracy, on the one hand, you've got many viewers of January the 6th and the inquiry into January the 6th. Who feel that the threat to democracy is the challenge to the legal structure of elections that has been made by the former president and many of his supporters. About two-thirds of Republicans still believe that the last election was stolen, or at least very fishy. So they detect a threat to democracy, and they perceive the unhappiness of Democrats at Trump's actions as being part of that threat. Whereas, of course, the Democrats themselves see the threat to democracy as the fact that an incumbent president and his supporters were willing to build up the expectation that the election would be stolen in order to generate a near insurrection. And they're worried about the fact that the recent Washington Post or New York Times article just last week reported 299 senior Republican candidates on the ballot this autumn are election deniers. every senior Republican nominated for an office in Arizona are election deniers, including the guy who would take over the running of elections, Lex Saab, Secretary of State, who's got an interesting life himself. So there is generally shared perception, but it's come through referring back to a question, this polarized lens. And so it's what it's generating is more and more intense differentiation between the sides. And I think one of the things that's been increasingly remarked upon is the violence and vituperativeness of language being used. So Marjorie Taylor Greene saying, the Democrats want the Republicans dead. They've started doing it. Seems a little bit extreme. All you're doing is standing for re-election.
So the floor is yours, the audience. Questions? Yes.
Yeah, hi,
please remember to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit before you.
Okay. Hi, my name is Christian. I'm an MSc student here at LSE. I'm from the States. Obviously, I'm from Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I have two questions about your comments on polarization. In my state, there's a governor's race. Josh Shapiro is going up against Mach Dreyan, who, by the way, was at the January 6th insurrection.
Yeah.
So that's a huge theme in my home state. One thing that the Shapiro group has done is actually in the Republican primaries funded campaign ads in favor of Mastriano.
Yeah.
With this idea that it would be easier to beat Mastriano than whoever his opponent was. I'm curious what your thoughts on those strategies are, if that's an effective or ultimately a dangerous strategy. And my second question regarding polarization is recently we've seen this attempt to form a third party, the Forward Party. Headlined by Andrew Yang. Is that a viable option in the, not in this election, obviously, yeah, but in the next 10 years, 20 years, or is that not going to happen?
Okay, we'll come to Andrew Yang in a moment. I have fond memories of Pennsylvania, I'd swore more. Funding more extreme candidates. It is true that in some constituencies, the Republicans may have nominated candidates who are too extreme to win an election that might otherwise have been winnable. I've forgotten his name now, the Brigadier General who has been nominated for the Republicans against Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire, for instance, appears to be unpalatable if the polls are right. As we know, polls aren't always right. In an election that the Republicans might otherwise have expected to win, and that it looks as though that might be true in Pennsylvania too. Although it's much closer there, it's still close. It's about 2% margin or something, isn't it? Very, very, very close. Which again is virtually zero in polling. Pollington. So it is, you know, it's the whole thing about riding the tiger, isn't it, really? You know, it's great to ride the tiger until the tiger eats you. The Republicans themselves, you know, in 6 years ago, they didn't want Trump Republican leadership. But as he became more and more powerful, quite a few people moved to him because they thought they could ride the tiger and see the result of that one, for instance. Trump's still knocking them about quite considerably. Third party, Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang's a very nice man, I met him. Met him and his wife and talked mainly about disabled children because they've got one of my grandchildren. And it was a charming discussion. So I have very warm feelings about him. But I think in terms of developing a third party, there's no evidence since 1854 that a third party can break through, except possibly on a local level. You know, there have been temporary experiences like Bernie Sanders in Burlington, Vermont, and he became mayor by accident, really. It was there was a scandal for one of the other parties, I can't remember which, and he ended up basically winning on one third of the vote in a three-way race. And then, and this is interesting, proving that he was good at running a city, and so people re-elected him. So that can happen. If you can get elected and then run things well, you get re-elected. But third parties have never, American elections are so expensive. It's so difficult to build up an infrastructure that the prospect of a third party, particularly being started from top down, I think is very unlikely.
So we have a couple of questions from online listeners. So here's one from Omar Hamid at Newcastle University, who asks, how critical could the reversal of Roe v. Wade be for turnout? And is there any historical precedent for such a judicial impact on previous midterms? So maybe the electoral math is different now because of Roe v. Wade.
Well, the electoral math is different. It's a good question. The Dobbs decision threw a bit of a bomb into things. But when it comes to elections, it's in America, on the whole, the issues that people vote on when they go in are the economy and how I'm feeling. There was an opinion poll published this weekend by the Washington Post and ABC News. I find it very interesting because if you ask people what the single most important issue then abortion came second, or right to choose, however you want to put it. Abortion came second behind, I think the economy was first. The economy was first, abortion was second, inflation was third. If, however, you looked at the conflation of those people who thought it was the most important issue and those who thought it was a very important issue, abortion dropped to sixth. So there isn't depth of feeling there, there's intensity. Mm-hmm. Without depth. And the only thing in the seven issues that they asked about that came lower was climate change. So things like crime, inflation, and so on, immigration, all, if you conflate the two top Trump, so to speak, the abortion issue. So the next question really is that intensity going to swing a few votes? Because the truth is that the margins in many of these important elections are quite small. So if the margin is only 3% and you can swing 3%, you've got it. If you divide the most intense responses on the abortion issue, the numbers are 2-1 Democrats. So most of these are Democrats who are going to vote Democratic anyway. It might encourage them to turn out. Mm. Midterm turnout tends to be lower, a lot lower than presidential turnout. So it might have that effect, but is it going to actually turn a whole swath of Republican women voters, Republican white women voters, you know? When did whites last vote for a Democratic candidate at presidential level? 1964. It'll be very interesting to see. In elections that are very tight, it might have an impact. If the momentum can keep going in those issues, but again, they tend to get a bit less.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, so many. Let's collect a couple of questions for Phil. How about you right there?
So I have a question about Georgia and the election between Warnock and Walker for the Senate.
Yeah.
And the recent revelations about Walker and paying for an ex-girlfriend's abortion when he is running on the position of banning all abortions. Do you think that's that bad media coverage for him by right-wing press such as Fox will have any effect on Republican turnout for Walker?
Yeah. You might.
The person in the back over there.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Arjun, and I'm a third-year BSc student. My question picks up on your point you made about sort of election denial. And it's really, do you think the more sort of low level positions like Secretary of State will be more prominent and important at this midterm? Because often in the past, they're considered, you know, like these lower level ones, you know, not as important as House and Senate races. But like we've mentioned, in places like Arizona, Trump's been endorsing a lot of candidates for these positions. And I think if they get elected, that could have some quite, you know, important implications for, say, 2024. Like it perhaps in favor of himself, or if it's another Republican candidate in favor of them. So I was sort of curious about that.
Yeah.
Let's get one more. Yes.
I'm a BSc student, and I spent the last year in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, working on the election. And one thing that I noticed was in America, the preservation of social rank has really led to an intense amount of polarization, which has led to a very big urban-rural divide. And I wanted to ask, what do you think the tension between that preservation of social rank and polarization really is? Do you think that that's what's leading to it? Or do you think it's the urban-rural divide? Or do you think it's just very intense party politics? So what exactly is causing it?
Preservation of social, I don't quite understand what you mean by that.
I mean that in general in America, that I think that I feel the opinions held by people in certain economic classes are very common. Especially in states that have very significant urban centers, such as Pennsylvania. So I think that I wanted to ask if you think that that's leading, that economic differentiation is leading to polarization, or do you think there's some other cause to that stark black and white?
Right, thank you very much. Yeah, okay. Okay. Election, let me do it. Let's have a look at election offices first. Certainly the Republicans have targeted election offices, and Arizona is an interesting example, as I said, because Trump's got involved. But even in states where Trump hasn't got involved, it's not all Trump. It's also about his facilitators within the Republican Party. They created the opportunity for him, and they are very skillful strategists at state and local level. The Democrats have been completely outplayed at state level for the last 30 years. Since 1994, wasn't it? Really, the big swing, the first midterm of Clinton. Since then, the Democrats have really been diminished in their power at state and local level. And then they did Operation Red Map, which was a redirection of campaign funding from national elections into state and local elections, at that time, initially, particularly into state legislative elections, and realizing that if you've got a donor who's got, I don't know, $10 million, well, certainly that's very welcome in Senate and House, but at a state level, you can influence complete swaths of legislative elections with that money. You know, putting $50,000 into each of your state legislative candidates' campaigns can really change things in a way that it won't change things in a Senate election. And so you can win states. And they've been really good at that. And the latest move, I'll give you another one. But certainly the concentration on state election offices is building on this strategy. And you're quite right, they've got candidates up for a lot of these. The only pollster I can see who's following it with any closeness is Larry Sabato. Look at Larry Sabato's pages. He's got a list of state secretary races and those safe and those at risk. And in broad terms, basically, fewer of the Democrats are safe and more of them are at risk than Republicans in those offices. And so, when it comes to declaring an election null and void or who's won, then this could have an influence. And of course, the Supreme Court decision is about to come on. Case in North Carolina, if I remember rightly, where there's potential, might not happen, for the Supreme Court, which has been increasingly handing power back into state hands, is specifically going to look at a case where they might and even more power over the conduct of elections down the state. So a combination of these things is really potentially significant. It might all fizzle out, but the combination is quite significant. Herschel Walker sports. One isn't saying that sports people don't deserve to be politicians. Some of them really show the intelligence, knowledge, dedication, and so on to deserve it. In my opinion, Herschel Walker doesn't fall into that category. And yes, the revelation, which he denies, of course, but the lady says she's got the receipts, that he pressured her to have an abortion, pay for it. And so on
but and so. Phil, maybe this is an opportunity to connect this to something that Marcia raised earlier. What is the role of the media in all of this? So I think one interest in the audience was, how does the media filter any of this news to a highly polarized electorate who is getting two very different versions of the same facts?
It's very, right? That's a really good tie-in, one thing first, we've seen in recent years anyway, candidates with strong support overcoming the problem of sexual and other difficulties, the former president being one such example of somebody overcoming that, and indeed a former Democratic president too. So it's quite clear that loyal voters can be very forgiving. But yes, it also does depend on how the voters are getting their opinion. And you do have this problem, if you see it as a problem, that while America, in some ways, it has a highly pluralized media system, it doesn't act as a pluralized system on many individuals, because they, rather than choosing a selection of media channels with moderately different opinions, they tend to hone in on a set of media channels that reinforce the echo chamber, as it's been called, that tend to reinforce opinions. And this actually has, again, something I just read the other day, it seems to have interaction with categories of voters. There are a group of alternative social media, so we're not talking Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter here. We're talking Parlay and Telegram, and those. And they tend to be less regulated, more conservative in the opinions that are shared there, and generally more extreme. And in one sense, you can say, well, actually, only a small proportion of people use it, about 6 to 6.5% of the respondents to, I think it was a Pew survey, they took a lot of their political news from these locations. But, well, while most of those, when the breakdown was done, in most groups, the breakdown of the viewers of the and listeners to these readers of these channels reflected pretty much the national group. The one group that was overrepresented though was Hispanics, which was substantially overrepresented among the groups listening to these to this particular echo chamber. So yeah, it does have impact. And you do, it's always been true, of course, that, coming to England rather than the UK, you know, when I was young, in my house, we took the Daily Herald, which was a Labour newspaper. Next door took the Telegraph, which was and still is the voice of Smith Square. And so I've always had that. Well, when there, possibly when there were fewer channels, and where particularly when the television was dominant, or before that radio was dominant, and these were a limited number of channels who also had fairness regulations. You know, Reagan's Federal Communications Commission got rid of fairness regulations in American media, there was a greater chance for cross-fertilization.
So I'm conscious that we're almost out of time, so I want to give this back to Masha. She wanted to say something about Benjamin.
Well, I was just mulling over with your fascinating remarks, Phil. I think you could go easily for another few hours, and we still have more questions to ask you about what Benjamin Franklin would make of all this. When I think about Franklin and his non-confrontational style, using the Socratic method to elicit views in his political opponent, I think he would be surprised, but where do you think Franklin would come down on the midterms and the state of U.S. democracy?
No, I'm not sure the Socratic method's always that brilliant. My philosophy lecturer, I remember, at Swarthmore, saying the problem with the Socratic method is that one person is Socrates and all the others are stupid. Franklin was, as I know, was stupid, and I think he'd be shocked by the vigorousness and viciousness of the debate that's going on within the United States. Now, he was shocked by the viciousness of the debate between Britain and America, quite rightly, and he was treated horribly by the British. For all the efforts that he put into keeping people together. Remember when they did finally write the Constitution, Franklin was there, whether it's true or not, he reported as saying, "We must all hang together or we'll surely hang separately." And the truth is, at the moment, America is not hanging together.
So I think with that, we're out of time. If people are hanging around, maybe we can continue to chat afterwards, but I have to let the speakers and the moderators go today. So thank you so much for this fascinating conversation.
Thank you.